Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast. I'm Dr. Neha Pathak, WebMD's Chief Physician Editor for Health and Lifestyle Medicine. Today, we're shining a spotlight on the pressing health disparities that disproportionately impact the Black community. How do barriers in access to healthcare contribute to current health disparities? And how do they spill over into worse health outcomes for Black individuals? We'll explore the power of community-based programs and initiatives and discover how they're making a difference to help address health disparities and promoting better health outcomes within the Black community. Let me introduce my guest, Dr. Georges Benjamin. Dr. Benjamin is one of the nation's most influential physician leaders. He speaks passionately and eloquently about the health issues having the most impact on our nation today. From his firsthand experience as a physician, he knows what happens when preventive care is not available and when the healthy choice is not the easy choice. As executive director of APHA since 2002, that's the American Public Health Association, he is leading the association's push to make America the healthiest nation. Welcome to the WebMD Health Discovered podcast, Dr. Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
Before we jump into our topic today, I'd love to talk about your own personal health discovery. What was your aha moment around the need for policy work around health disparities and the actions you've taken since that discovery?
Well, you know, I spent the first half of my time in medicine, practicing emergency medicine. And early in my career, about 2.5 years, I spent as chief of community medicine at the city hospital in Washington, D.C. And of course, when you're in a city hospital, you see all kinds of things that are prevention oriented. You see the things where society has really let people down, in addition to the things in the health system that just don't work well. And the more important part was they don't work differentially for certain people, lower income individuals, communities of color, individuals that have been discriminated against for a variety of reasons, low income whites in rural settings. And then when you really go way upstream and think about the root causes of what those things were, that was an aha for me. You know, the fact that no matter who you were and how prosperous you were, these societal things were just so overwhelming. They resulted in health inequities that we could do something about. And so since that time, I've spent a lot of time, both on the policy side, on the practice side, trying to find ways to fix those issues, both financially, policy-wise, and even in clinical practice.
I always say the only thing that doesn't give me imposter syndrome is identifying myself as a primary care doctor. That's where I see sort of so much of what I find passion in doing. And so much of what we do is going upstream of the problem that's in front of us in that clinical setting. So I'm just appreciative of all the work that you've done. So since this episode is really focused on health disparities, specifically in the Black community, I'd love it if you could talk about some of the major health disparities that your work centers around.
When we look at health disparities, particularly in the Black community, we talk a lot about access to care, differences in access to care, differences in the quality of care received within the healthcare setting. And that includes prevention and wellness that occurs before you actually see a doctor. Individual issues around care-seeking behavior, where people don't seek the kind of care they should receive in many ways because they've been disincentivized to see that care, or there have been barriers that have prevented them from seeking that care before, so they just give up. And then the fourth one is these social determinants, the fact that there are societal things that are barriers to people receiving care. And at the end of the day, all those result in people dying sooner, people living less long, so affecting your life expectancy, even though you may not be as healthy as you could be, even though you may live longer. Differences in mental health and just your general well-being. And what I would argue is differences in the burden of diseases. So we talk about disease burden, you talk about more heart disease, more lung disease, more cancer, more asthma, as an example, more injury, and not just gun violence, but other forms of injury. We've talked a lot lately about the fact that being a Black woman who's pregnant results in a much higher risk of dying during pregnancy or in the month and a half after you deliver.
What are some of the major policy interventions that you are working on to address these various pillars that undergird why we have these health disparities?
on the healthcare side, we're working really hard to get a system with everyone in and no one out. So to get everyone access to health insurance coverage. As you know, we still have about 10 states who have not yet adopted the Medicaid expansion, for example. We are working to try to reduce the cost of care. Increasingly, co-payments, deductibles, cost of premiums, those kinds of things are barriers to people who are eligible to get insurance coverage, but can't afford the insurance coverage. And even when they have the insurance card, don't have the $20 to go out and actually do that patient visit or the $20 to go and get the medication filled. So reducing the cost of care. I think we're spending a lot of time trying to educate people around unconscious biases. There are, of course, racism and discrimination that is overt, but there are so many structural things in our system which discriminate against people, whether you know the health system is located, the hours in which the clinic or the doctor's office are open, how you get treated when you go into the office, all those things which serve as barriers to receiving quality care. We're working on both educating people and working with our medical care colleagues to change some of those policies.
And I'm very curious about where you see the role of peer support or community health workers, community health organizations in the types of interventions that you're thinking about.
Well, my first public health job was the health commissioner in Washington, D.C. And one of the things that I realized I had immediately were these amazing people that went into the community and did engagement of communities. We had HIV/AIDS workers who went into the communities to talk to people about HIV/AIDS and risk reduction, using a condom, safer sex practices. We had people who went into the maternal child health community and talked a lot about being healthy before you got pregnant, having all your health visits, what were some of the risk factors that cause a poor pregnancy outcome. We did a lot of people that went in the communities and just dealt with distressing these women. We had a place called Health Corners where we took public housing unit that was not yet being used, and we trained community folks. We paid them minimum wage, and they did health education around healthy eating, blood diabetes, measuring blood pressure in a range of people. And they were particularly focused on women who were pregnant. And of course, in many cases, these were teens and young kids who were getting pregnant. And we were working with them to make sure that they had healthy pregnancies, which we did a lot to try to encourage them not to get pregnant, but it happened. And so we worked with them. And we did a lot of work with those outreach workers on tobacco, which is still the leading preventable cause of death and disproportionately impacts communities of color and in many cases, low-income folks. And then many of them start smoking as children.
Part of my work is in the VA healthcare system. And that's certainly a system where more and more we've been relying on sort of the peer support, the lived experience, being able to be a trusted messenger to relay these health messages in a way that makes sense to the folks that we're trying to reach out to, depending on their condition, depending on the conditions of their legal circumstances, their social circumstances. So we've certainly been seeing that as being a really helpful way of already being embedded in the system. So as new concerns come up, so for example, with COVID and the COVID vaccines, we could then deploy these trusted messengers to outreach around that messaging as well.
Well, this question, look, these folks know the hood. I'm a long way from being young enough and engaged enough in the community to be able to know what Johnny's doing or Mrs. Jones is doing or what their needs are. And so having these folks that actually are living the same life experience as many of the patients that we're trying to engage, they're trusted, right? Because they've been vetted by real life by the people that live in their community. And quite frankly, they can augment my message. I would hope that I'm a trusted messenger, but I'm probably not as trusted as for many things as these other folks.
What other interventions have you seen or found to be really successful at reducing disparities? And what kind of work is being done to scale these or replicate these successes in other regions?
You know, in the access area, making sure that the services are available and that people can get to them. During COVID, as you know, we had terrible disparities and eventually did all the right things. We made sure that people could get to the doctor's office. They could get to the testing sites. We provided opportunities for these centers to be open on weekends and evenings. We enhanced their ability to engage remotely by expanding telemedicine, for example. And of course, many people have a cell phone, but they don't have a smartphone. And so many of the things that they could do with a smartphone, they couldn't do with their cell phone. But by providing places where people could go to get to provide those services, to enhance internet services in the community, we were able to expand those services, making sure that the people that are providing the care know the community, you know, linking people to a good primary care system and a good primary care provider, real efforts to do that. And we talked a lot about reducing the cost of care, trying to make these services much more affordable are things that we can scale up. Look, these things aren't rocket science. These are things that have been proven to improve access to care. We're now seeing more and more efforts where people are not receiving the same quality of care, even in the same setting, and trying to identify that through data and then correcting that is important. I think that one other thing, of course, is the whole issue around health literacy, empowering the community by giving them information. Because what often happens is people often get information from somebody that they know. And I remember during COVID, we had several groups that educated barbers and beauticians around vaccines, around health education broadly, around COVID. Because, you know, when you're sitting there, eventually we got out and about, but if you're sitting there in the barbershop, a lot of information gets exchanged. People do validate what they've heard from their neighbors, from their friends, from their barber, from their beautician. And so to the extent that we can empower them with the right information, the information they can then give, is it validates the information that the person got from their clinician. And I think that can be very powerful when someone hears about high blood pressure and they think that the only way you know your blood pressure is high is if you're symptomatic, to have somebody that you trust while they got you in that chair, fixing your hair, telling you, no, hypertension is a silent killer. Tobacco use is bad for you. And here's why. Because we always say that people need to hear things seven times before it sticks, and often they need to hear it from several different messengers. So having those lay messengers to give that information not only empowers them for their own health, but also empowers their customers.
How do you encourage folks to advocate for themselves? What types of questions should they be asking? What should they be looking for? What are red flags that would suggest that they need to be sort of asking more questions potentially?
You know, if it doesn't sound right, you need more information. If you're not leaving that office fully understanding everything, you need to say, "Doc, stop. I need more information about this." You should often get a second opinion, particularly if a surgical procedure or someone wants to do something that's invasive to you. I encourage people to look things up on the internet. You need to go to credible sources, professional societies, and places that are likely to give you the right information. But validate everything you do. Don't take everything on face value. And when you get conflicting information, then you need to look and see what you think is the right information. And you can always go back to your provider and say, "Look, I didn't understand what you said." And you need to be comfortable saying that. And if they don't have the time to talk to you, and they may not at that particular visit, but if they can't give you the answers that you need, then you probably need to go get a new provider, one that you're more comfortable with.
Yeah. So I think that really thinking about your comfort and that gut feeling of you're getting, when you have a question, that provider is there for you, is really important when you're having that conversation. Unfortunately, it puts an added burden on someone to have to do that extra legwork, but I think an important message nonetheless.
Well, it is, but let me tell you something. When you go to buy a car or you go to buy a house and you get that feeling, you don't buy there. And you ought to do the same thing when you're talking to your health provider, because it is your health and it's very important.
Can you talk a little bit about the experience of accessing health and getting high quality health care, regardless of socioeconomic status with regard to the Black community? Because we hear about health disparities, even for those that have a lot of health information, access to the best healthcare facilities, we're still seeing disparities.
You do. And, you know, we've seen that some highly visible athletes that have had poor health outcomes. And in those cases, what we're told is that they said, "Look, I think, Doc, this is what's going on with me." And the clinician didn't listen. And so that's why hearing and communicating is very important, making sure it's a two-way conversation, that they're speaking and then you speaking, and that you're both listening to one another and you're not talking by one another. And you're saying, but doc, I hear that, but here's what's going on with my body. And the clinician needs to spend the time to listen, because it's just so important to do that. And what happens often is we make some assumptions about people because of who they are, how they're trained, how much money they have. They often are just given the answer because people just assume they understand, but they oftentimes don't. And I got to tell you, as a physician, when I go to physicians who don't know I'm a physician, I often won't tell them right off the bat that I'm a physician. I want them to give me the version that they give everybody else. And then when I want to ask questions, I do. And because sometimes they make assumptions that I know things that I don't. And yes, I trained in internal medicine. Yes, I'm boarded. Yes, I was an emergency physician. But, you know, like anything else, when I go to a doctor, I'm a patient. And I want to hear what every other patient hears and understand what every other patient understands. That doesn't mean I may be a little more fast when looking it up later. But I want to hear what my doc has to say. I want to get their best advice, just as I would with my accountant or my lawyer or my best friend who wants to give me advice around something that's important to me.
Particularly if you are concerned, if you're questioning, it really is important to just say, listen, take a breath here. I really need you to answer this question for me because I don't understand, or I am feeling this and it's been going on for months.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also don't assume that they assume that you're giving them the information, because people interpret things very differently.
Do you have any sort of interventions or work that you're doing with regard to training the next generation? So younger generations, are there interventions? Is there work being done to sort of help address the disparity at a younger age?
There's a lot of work being done to empower trainees, new clinicians, to understand microaggressions, to understand biases. We all have things that we perceive about people before they come in based on our life experiences. And the key here is to understand them and to acknowledge them and to work through them, because we carry those biases with them. Some of them, by the way, are biases which we were trained. When I was in medical school, we were taught that women didn't have heart attacks, who were premenopausal, at the same rate as men. And in many cases, you know, yeah, you eventually got to thinking about it could be a heart attack, but it wasn't at the top of your list. And boy, was that a mistake. Now, once you look at the real data, I mean, being premenopausal is important, but I got to tell you, it's not as much of a factor as we thought it was. So those biases you carry into your practice, and you have to learn to, in some ways, unlearn those things.
Well, I just so appreciate you taking the time to spend some time talking with us today. And I'd love to close the episode with giving you the floor. What would be some bite-sized action items for someone who's listening who might be able to take some of what we've talked about today and implement these changes in their day-to-day lives?
I think life is very stressful. So the most important thing, I think, for everybody is always spend every day to have some me time, some time and then just be quiet and just relax and try to de-stress any way you feel like distressing. The second thing is do your own health check. Identify what your health needs are, make a plan, and then proceed on it. And then I think finally, become as knowledgeable as you can about your own health, the health of your family members, and help others to do the same thing.
Thank you so, so much for being with us today. We've talked with Dr. Georges Benjamin about health disparities in the Black community. And certainly some of the things I'm taking away are, before you're sick, in order to expand that health span, really think about who those trusted messengers are in your life. Who are those people where you feel you can ask your questions? It doesn't have to be a health professional. It could be someone in another setting, but that you recognize is going to be someone that has your back, that is going to provide you with really vetted health information. So thank you so much for your time. To find out more information about Dr. Georges Benjamin and his work, please visit apha.org.
Thank you very much, Dr. Patty.
Thank you for listening. Please take a moment to follow, rate, and review this podcast on your favorite listening platform. If you'd like to send me an email about topics you're interested in or questions for future guests, please send a note at webmdpodcast@webmd.net. This is Dr. Neha Bartuk for the WebMD Health Discovered Podcast.